Thank you, Mr. Pavlik, and good afternoon to all. Beautiful Sabbath day out there. We enjoyed our drive to Youngstown and back this morning, and certainly pass on their greetings to you as well. Beginning this service today, the sermon itself, do a little reflective thinking here with you, if you don't mind. The last 3 months for Janelle and me have been one of those stretches, it has been a stretch, where everything in our lives seemed like it was just constantly in motion. And I'm sure that everybody here has experienced times like that, where it just seems like hardly anything slows down. Best laid plans of mice and men, we tried during the time in Texas, in the extended time there, 3.5 weeks, we tried to take actually 4 days off in between teaching at FI and the conference, and then because of a family emergency with my wife's brother, her older brother Gary, some of you may actually go back far enough in Akron to remember him, had a stroke last September, and then it appears that he had a seizure that was generated by scar tissue from the stroke, and we had to make an immediate trip up there to see him, which was a little over a 700-mile round trip from Dallas up to northwest Arkansas. And yet because of, well, the exigencies of his situation and missing connections at the hospital on the way up, he was discharged to go home. We were able to spend 30 minutes with him, and that was it. And then his issues began to surface. He was having some pain and struggling to construct the words the way they should be. That's one of the, he's not had any paralysis, but his speaking is garbled. And sometimes you can guess at it, and sometimes you just kind of nod and so that he keeps going and hope you can figure it out beyond that. But so it didn't turn out like we had planned. It was personal time off, but it wasn't exactly a relaxing time. Somehow, though, those stretches just seemed to come. And again, I'm sure every one of you has had something like that. And in comparison to other stretches of time in your life, it just feels like you can't stop moving. Of course, as I said, I know everybody here has experienced that. I'm not trying to say, oh, ours was, we're not into one-upmanship. It's just that as a background for what I want to talk about today, I want to speak about the concepts and the way things hit us. I think we all come to a place once in a while, I know we certainly do, where we look for that space of time that David talked about in the Psalms, where he called it in some translations a wide place or a wide space, where the spaces somehow ease up and you can just relax just a little bit and catch your breath before the next round. And other times it's just those spaces seem to constrict and feel different and you long again for a bit of a break in the action of some sort. If any of that sounds familiar, then I'm going to guess that you're with me and you understand it. You know what I'm talking about. Some of the events, of course, were joyful, like reaching the milestone of 50 years of marriage and the joy we had in sharing it with all of our children being here last weekend and all of our grandchildren, missing one son-in-law because of a job commitment he couldn't get out of, short of perhaps risking losing the job, which we certainly wouldn't have advised. And in fact, we're going to drive down there tomorrow and spend some time with them on Father's Day. But so many of our spiritual family members, too. Many of you were at the little drop-in last Sunday. We figure we had about 75 people there. And the absolute love and generosity that so moved us both from so many sources, we really do thank you deeply from the bottom of our hearts for that recognition. We actually had the chance this morning to recognize another couple in the Youngstown congregation who are way ahead of us. Don and Faye Lambert just celebrated their 67th anniversary. So they're two-thirds of the way to 100. And, of course, she was saying he was 10 and she was 6 when they got married. Nobody was buying it. So, but the time moves along. It just keeps going and going and going. We get locked in sometimes to those spaces and times, but inevitably the pace does change eventually. Reminded me of something I used to hear when I was a younger man. We had a little montage of pictures that kept rolling last Sunday. I don't know who that young guy was with that thick, you know, head of curly brown hair, but somebody. Back when I still remember who he was, he used to hear a white-haired old gentleman preach and hear him say, It's like being a photographer. It's all in where you put the camera. It's in your point of view. He was right. Some call it by different names. Point of view, where you're coming from, where your focus is, what your frame of reference is. There are all kinds of ways of describing it. You and I, you heard a reference in the sermonette today to the annual holy days, God's annual festivals and special times, commanded observances, commanded assemblies. We're in the position right now of being between holy days. I guess technically we always are, but we're shifting gears right now between the Feast of Weeks time, or Pentecost, and the fall festivals that are looming ahead. We're hearing announcements about the fall festivals. This needs to be done. That needs to be done. Making your plans and preparations. And we're shifting from our remembrances, essentially, of past events commemorated by the ones we've kept so far this year, with the, of course, the allowance that Pentecost also is like a way of identifying who we are. It tells us who we are as the first fruits, but it also commemorates an event that happened nearly 2,000 years ago. And the thought struck me the other day that it's, in one sense, it's not far. It's only 8 years away where we could actually say on Pentecost, we could say 2,000 years ago today, on this festival, the Holy Spirit was given. We're only 8 years away from being able to say it was now 2,000 years ago that the church began. And I hope and pray that many of us will still be around to recognize that time frame. But we're moving to a focus on something we've never seen. Every one of the fall festivals points to a future event. And that's the way God set up the pattern. And four of the seven festivals come in that bunch. You know, it's a glut of festival observances. It's all together. Within a 22-day span, inclusively, we have four festivals. So we begin to ask questions, or at least I do. Where do I put the camera? Where are we coming from? Where are we headed? What's my focus? What's my frame of reference in taking a look at these events that are yet future, but while we don't know the timing of it, we can surely say without being, you know, fear of correction, it's closer than it's ever been. But again, let's think about that concept of focus or frame of reference. Where do we put it in our thinking about God's plan? I'd like to get into that today by using four examples from God's Word. I'm not sure whether it's carbs or proteins or what, but it's a matter of four examples from God's Word that involve the lives of human beings. And there will be a thread running through it as we step back and take a look. And keep thinking about some of those basic questions. Where am I putting the camera? What am I focusing on? What's my frame of reference as I look at these examples? The first one is in beginning in Genesis 37. You might be able to identify it just by the book and the chapter. It's part of the story of Joseph. It's really toward the beginning of his story because if we look at verse 2, we can identify exactly how old he is. Genesis 37 and verse 2 says, "This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers." So, that's the beginning. Joseph is 17 years of age. He's with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, you can read the rest of this chapter early on, and you'll see the whole sequence of dreams that he had, and how deliriously happy that made his brothers. Okay, that's not quite the way it happened. But here's where the story starts. We find at one point that his brothers have taken the sheep and they've not been heard from for a while. Jacob, their father, Jacob, or as he was renamed Israel, gets worried. And so in verse 15, Joseph is sent to try to find them. So he's out looking, and a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" He said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they're feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They've departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan or Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them right where this man said they would be, in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Resentment ran awfully deep. We're not told who all was in on that discussion. It would appear from a later reference that certainly Reuben was probably not part of it. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we'll say," well, we'll say to whom? Obviously, they're thinking about how they're going to make this explanation to their dad. "We'll say some wild beast has devoured him, and then we'll see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, "Let us not kill him." And he said, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness." So he went along with part of their solution, but he wanted to cast him in live, not dead. "And don't lay a hand on him." And then here's the reasoning given. He had a different thought in mind, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to their father, or to his father. So that was Reuben's intent, which was a good one. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. It was a mark of his father's affection, and it was a mark, frankly, of unwise favoritism because of the resentment that it built in the other sons. And of course, it goes back to the fact that it wasn't the typical family God intended of a nuclear family, one man, one woman. There were four wives in this case, in a time when polygamy was allowed, but they were still considered to be Jacob's wife. Obviously, God did not intend that from the beginning. There were a lot of things we find that he simply said, "I'll put up with it for now, but it's not what I intended." So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, we read the verse, they stripped his tunic off, they took him and cast him into a pit. It was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Let's stop just for a moment. Think about where things are. What was going through Joseph's mind at this point? What could he see from deep in a dry pit? He could see a little tiny hole, and the sky was through it. What could he hear? No doubt, the sounds of his brothers eating lunch, deciding what to do with him. What could he focus on? How am I going to get out of here? What's his frame of reference? Not a very happy one. What's my future look like? You can hear the voices of your brothers if you're Joseph. Maybe arguing. And maybe he's trying to figure out what are they arguing about now. And then he hears the sounds of a caravan, a trade caravan. Of Ishmaelites, relatives, really, because Ishmael, of course, was the half-brother of Isaac, the father of Jacob. Because it says, they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. And Judah makes the observation. He says, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Let's sell him." Not exactly a sterling moment for Judah. Although at least it would preserve Joseph's life temporarily. They had no way of knowing what would happen after that. And his brothers listened. So they pulled him up out of the pit, sold him for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Look at what happens, though. Reuben returned, and he wasn't in the pit, and he tore his clothes, an evidence of grief, of extreme displeasure. He said, "The lad is no more. Where shall I go?" So now they cook up this story, dip the tunic in the blood of some of the goats, and take it back to their father and say, "This is what we found. Does this belong to Joseph?" Terrible thing. Terrible thing. That's Joseph's story. And you're wondering, if you're Joseph in that pit, your brothers are arguing. They're talking. Then they haul you up, and the next thing you know, you're taken off to Egypt as a slave. First, before that, you're probably thinking, are they going to leave me in this pit to die? When they went to pull him up, maybe he was a little happier. Will they kill you themselves? He had to wonder. All of it in Joseph's mind. What did his future look like to him? Next step, the book of Job. We'll come back to all of these. All four examples. Job chapter 1. We have an interesting insight into the spirit world, the angelic realm. That God, in effect, is having a meeting of the angels at his throne. And he allows Satan, the former Lucifer, to come to the meeting. He asks him, where do you come from? He said, from going to and fro on the earth, walking back and forth, kind of an evasive answer. And God introduces the concept of Job. He says, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. He basically pokes Satan and goads him into a response. Why did he do that? Satan responds, he goes for the bait. Does Job fear God for nothing? And we have this exchange. You've made a hedge all around him, around his household. You've blessed his work, his possessions. Stretch out your hand, touch everything he has, he'll curse you. And so, picking it up in verse 13, here's what happens. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. They have killed your servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants. And they've been consumed. And I alone have escaped to tell you. So his oxen are gone. His donkeys are gone. The Sabaeans have raided them. The sheep are gone. The servants of both groups. While he was still speaking, another came and said that Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away. And they killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Three major sources of wealth for his time. The animals that he had, the livestock, and all the servants who took care of them. While he was still speaking, another one came. And you have to wonder, when Job saw another gesticulating, excited servant, now what? What else is there? Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. What's Job thinking here? Well, we have his words recorded. He arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshipped and said, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I'll return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And he did not sin or charge God with wrong. And then there's another meeting in heaven in chapter 2. And this time Satan says, well, you didn't touch him. You didn't allow me to touch him. You strike his flesh and his bone, he'll curse you. God allowed it. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, verse 7 of chapter 2, struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. I've never had a boil. My younger brother did once. It was a large one. In fact, they referred to it, I think, as a carbuncle, if I recall correctly. It was so big. And I remember when the nurse had to come and lance it and try to, you know, get rid of the poison. And, yeah, that looked terrible. And he has a small scar to this day. I have no idea what it would be like to be head to toe boils. So he took a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Stop for a minute. What's going on in Job's mind? What could he see? What his body looked like? He would hear ringing in his ears his wife's advice. You still holding fast to your integrity? Why don't you just curse God and maybe he'll strike you down dead and then your suffering will be over? Not exactly a sterling moment for her either. Sitting on a pile of ashes, scraping at himself with a piece of broken pottery, wondering why all this is happening. So many questions. Is God dissatisfied with me? Is he upset with me? Is he punishing me? If he is, what is it I've done? How can I ask him for justice? I haven't cursed him. I haven't accused him of doing anything wrong. Wouldn't death be preferable to this? I wonder what thoughts went through his mind. And of course, we know the book goes on and there are other stages that are reached, but we'll get to that in a moment. Turn back a few pages to the book of Esther, previous book. The book of Esther. In chapter 1, we are introduced to a man called Ahasuerus. We believe it was Xerxes in history. And to Queen Vashti. We're not sure of all that went on there, but obviously she didn't take kindly to her husband's request, whatever it was. It may not have been very honorable. And in any case, she disregarded his command, and so she is deposed as queen. And so the whole premise of the book is set up that this king, a typical monarch of the time, of the eastern areas of Asia Minor, decides he's going to have what basically amounts to a rather rarefied, specialized beauty contest to pick a new queen. Pretty demeaning to women. And he ends up, it says in chapter 2 and verse 7, there is this individual by the name of Mordecai. He had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her parents died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter, cared for her, and raised her. And so it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, that when many young women were gathered at Shushan, or Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Essentially, we're talking about a harem here. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. 7 maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. So, you know, at her beck and call, he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Still doesn't sound very good, does it? She had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. He was worried sick and concerned for this young lady, this young woman who he felt like a father to. She was like his daughter. He cared deeply. Stop there. Put yourself in Esther's shoes. Why am I here? She would have said. What was she thinking about? What could she see? What was her focus? What was her frame of reference? What's happened to me? Why did the king's agents or soldiers take me to the House of the Women? Code name for harem. Even if I'm in the best place of the House of the Women, what good is that? Why can't I have one loving husband? Why am I surrounded by rivals for the king's affection? Why have I been taken from my home with my protective and caring cousin Mordecai? What am I doing here? One more story in John chapter 9. John 9 and verse 1. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. All right. What's your reaction if you see someone blind? My wife showed me a video the other day of a young blind woman playing an astounding piece on the piano. I don't know how in the world you do that. She was confident. She was hitting the right notes. She knew where the keys were. Astonishing. But here's the reaction from this time in history. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. Where have you heard that before? And his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" That's their assumption. Here's a blind man. Either he or his parents had to have sinned. Those are the options in their minds. That was the culture of the time. That's how this was viewed. Stop here for a moment. Put yourself in the blind man's shoes. It doesn't make sense to ask, what could he see? The answer was nothing. He never had seen anything. I don't even understand that. How do you relate to a world where you've never seen? You've never been a sighted person. Sometimes we find that individuals who are deprived of the use of one sense find the strengths of the others are honed and sharpened. We had a young lady many years ago at Camp Heritage that went on when we went on those whitewater rafting trips, she was in my raft, she and her mom. And when we would come in the river close to a railroad trestle with the trains, she was deaf. And she spotted that she could recognize the trains were there long before any of us could. She could feel the vibrations through the water in the raft. So sometimes the other senses are heightened. But this blind man, put yourself in his shoes. What could he focus on, if I can put it that way? What was his frame of reference? What was his world like? You know, sometimes people see something like that and they presume, in the case of a blind person, maybe he can't hear either, so I'll just talk louder. Or with a foreign language, somebody says, "Oh, you don't speak my language, I'll just talk English louder and then you'll understand me." That's not helpful. It's not logical either, but it happens all the time. If even Christ's disciples ask Jesus this question, who sinned? Did he sin somehow? Did his parents sin? What would have been on his mind, the blind man? What must public opinion have already concluded about him if the disciples of Jesus Christ asked this question? What was on his mind? Why does no one have a kind word for me? How long will my family continue to support me with what little I can contribute from my begging? Which is presumably what he was engaged in. He was by the side of the road. They walked by him. There he was. That's usually what was happening. What happens if my family disowns me? If they just cast me off? I won't even know where I am. How will I live then? Was I born in sin? Whose? Mine? My parents? My grandparents? The rabbis teach us that to the third and fourth generation. Are all the awful things I hear spoken about me, because they presume I can't hear them either, are all those awful things true? Are they right? Is that my life? Four stories. Centuries apart. No apparent connection of one to the other except for one common thread weaving through each life, and an answer in the scriptures for each one. The clue is in something I mentioned earlier, connected to thoughts engendered by sometimes a whirlwind series of events. Again, you've probably had those thoughts and times too. So here's the clue. God has a plan. He has a plan. Did any of these stories, any of these accounts, these lives, happen by accident? Were any of them accidental? Was there ever a time in any of them where God was not in charge? Any of these lives? Was there ever a single moment that passed without His knowledge or permission for the events to happen? No. They all happened for a reason. And each one for a specific reason that God had in mind that was revealed in each case later on. But that's the point for us. It always seems to be that it's not always immediately. There is one other common thread to the four stories, and that is that none of these four people knew those specific reasons for the events in their lives being allowed at first. Not one of them could see it when we're introduced to them in the accounts. Let's step back for a moment and think about what I asked you to keep in mind, which was, what can you see? What is your focus? What is your frame of reference? You and I are, at this moment, whirling around the sun on this planet we live on. Do you know how fast we're going? Roughly 66,000 miles per hour. That's the speed, basically, of the Earth in its orbit around the sun. About 66,000 miles per hour. You feeling dizzy? Probably not. That's because we're moving that fast, but thankfully so is the Earth that we're kind of anchored to. From what we can see, from what we can focus on, from our frame of reference, the world on which we live, the planet on which we live, is stationary, isn't it? We talk about terra firma, you know, solid ground. But it's moving at about 66,000 miles an hour. Thankfully, so are we. It seems to us that it's the universe around us that's doing all the moving. And it is, in part, because it's complicated. The frame of reference concept makes all the difference in a world. In the world, it's not a phrase we use very often, but it's a concept we're aware of every day. Let me illustrate it. It comes into play when we make observations like, oh, I looked at my speedometer. I'm going 5 miles per hour faster than the car next to me. I can tell. I just passed him. Or, I'm going 15 miles per hour over the speed limit right now. Or, wow, that state trooper with the flashing lights is sure gaining on me fast. Speed requires a frame of reference. You can't just be going 75 miles per hour. You have to be going 75 miles per hour in relation to something else. Here on planet Earth, our frame of reference is the surface of the planet itself, because that's where we are. So when the police officer asks us, and I don't have a large experience of this, you know, when he asks us if we knew how fast we were going, the correct reply is not a little faster than that other guy or slower than you were or 66,000 miles per hour with respect to the sun. So what's another 15 at this moment? That's probably not a good answer to give. He's asking how fast we were going in relation to the surface of the Earth. He probably doesn't say it because you'd think he was kind of a crazy trooper. And it would sound ridiculous because it's implied. And it would look really silly if the highway speed limit signs said speed limit 70 in relation to the surface of the Earth. Just not logical. Or 66,070 allowing, never mind. Here's a question. Does what we see or experience or focus on or our frame of reference make the speed at which the earth is traveling around the sun irrelevant? Well, no, it doesn't. All you have to do is imagine what would happen if the earth stopped traveling at 66,000 miles per hour around the sun, and we didn't. We'd have a little bit of difficulty hanging on. We would be like a slingshotted pea, you know, from a pea shooter, thrown out into space. You can get a very quick sense of why that number matters a very great deal. Think about Joshua's long day and all that was involved in that when the sun appeared to stand still. Try to figure that one out. And nobody flew off the earth. Our problem is that we're not really wired to keep track of multiple frames of reference at the same time. And honestly, unless you're a physics teacher or a rocket scientist, I doubt you have much reason to even think about these perspectives on a regular basis. Day in, day out, our limited frame of reference, our focus, what we see, our experience, our focusing, persuades us that we live on a stationary planet, an earth that remains perfectly still while the universe rolls by overhead. The truth of the matter is that we live on a massive, organic spaceship whirling its way around a star, nestled within a galaxy, traveling at unfathomable speeds through an ever-expanding universe. That's what's actually happening. But we don't think about it very much. Kind of hard to wrap our minds around. But it's still true. Let's get back to our four friends from Scripture. Joseph was in that pit for a purpose. Same thing is true for Job sitting on the ash heap, and Esther in the king's harem, and the blind man begging by the side of the road. They were all there for a purpose. But from what they could determine, from their focus, from what they could perceive, from their frame of reference, they couldn't figure it out, could they? For each one of them, their situation must have looked hopeless. From our example of the earth and the universe and that speeding ticket that you may or may not be getting, we know that all four of our biblical friends were looking at that stationary world. Even though everything looked like it was standing still to them, God was moving each one of them towards something. Maybe at 66,000 miles per hour. But for them, they still had to be asking, why me? Why is God allowing this? Doesn't he care? Has he forgotten about me? Wouldn't you or I be asking those questions? What they went through is far more dire than I think anything I've ever been through. I wouldn't make a claim to having gone through what any of these four were doing and what they were experiencing. Not at all. But you know, the thing is, none of those four stories stop with where we stopped, do they? Take Joseph, for example. How long until the picture became clear to Joseph? We know exactly from the scripture. It was 22 years. It was 22 years. He was sold as a slave at the age of 17. He was put in prison after temporarily serving Potiphar, the captain of the guard. We don't know how long, however long it took for Potiphar's wife to roll her eyes at him. And when he rolled them right back at her, she didn't know quite what to do with it. Sorry, bad pun. But he was falsely accused on a trumped-up charge. Makes me wonder if Potiphar knew something might be up, because he wasn't executed. He was just put in prison. And then at the age of 28, the butler and the baker had dreams in prison. And he was able, with God's help, because God gave him the ability to understand them, predict exactly the way it would help. And he thought, he must have thought, that's my ticket out of here. Because one of them gets restored to service to Pharaoh. And the weeks went by, turned into months, and two more years. And suddenly, Pharaoh has a dream. And the butler remembers, oh yeah, by the way, there was this guy in prison. And so at the age of 30, Joseph is hustled out of prison. He's cleaned up and presented to the Pharaoh. One morning he gets up and it's not different from all other mornings for who knows how long, 10 years, 12, 13, we don't know. And suddenly he's standing before Pharaoh, the most powerful man in his world physically. And he tells the story of the dreams. And Pharaoh is so impressed, he says, you are the man to handle the programs we need. And so the 7 good years go by. Now he's 37. And then 2 years of the famine progress. He's now 39. It's been 22 years since he was sold into slavery. When did he know? Genesis 45. Genesis 45. We read the backstory a little bit. The brothers have gone to Egypt to buy grain. He replaces their money in their sacks. He knows who they are. They finally come back again. He has maintained or held Simeon in prison. Simeon is restored. He sends his chalice in their money sacks again. They all come back. And now the brothers are desperate because it looks pretty bad and it was found in Benjamin's sack, Joseph's full brother. And so in chapter 45, Joseph knows. Can you see the lights going on in his head as he explains to his brothers? Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Wouldn't you like to have been a fly on the wall to have seen that? Does my father still live? But his brothers couldn't answer him. Basically, they were terribly shaken up. They were dumbstruck, is the translation in the Tanakh, the Jewish version. They were dumbstruck. They were dumbfounded in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near. He said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. What's he going to tell them? Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. I know why it happened. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of his house and ruler throughout all the land. And he says, hurry, get my father. Bring him here. What a story. 22 years until it became clear. Probably began to become clear when he recognized his brothers the first time. And I'm sure he recognized when they bowed down to him about the fulfillment of his dreams. But at first, Joseph didn't know. 22 years is a long time to spend as a slave and a prisoner, not knowing what's happening. Did Joseph ever give up? Did he have some bad moments? Oh, I imagine he did. For a purpose. What about the next step? Joseph couldn't see this for 22 years, but now finally the last pieces were in place, because he talks about the fact that Israel was to come to Egypt. Now he understood. Genesis 46, verse 3, he said, Israel took his journey. Now this is the vision that Israel or Jacob had before he made the trip. God spoke to him in the visions of the night, said, Jacob, Jacob. He said, here I am. Verse 3, I am God, the God of your father. Don't fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. That was his purpose. He wanted Israel's descendants to grow to greatness in Egypt. And that spreads out into another further purpose, doesn't it? All of this began to become clearer. God had a very important part of his plan to set in motion through Joseph. We know later on, after Jacob died and the brothers came to him worried in the last chapter of Genesis and for chapter 50, they were worried he would now take it out on them because Jacob was dead. And he told them, don't worry, I meant it. I'm here because God wanted me to preserve life. And he might have added Egyptian life as well as Israelite life. It all started in a pit. The same pit where Joseph had to have wondered if God had abandoned him. Had God abandoned Joseph? Not at all. Who gave him favor with Potiphar? Who gave him favor with the keeper of the prison? Who revealed the meaning of dreams to him? Who gave him favor in Pharaoh's court? Who put the idea in Pharaoh's head to make Joseph in charge of everything? God was with him every step of the way. But Joseph couldn't see it for 22 years. How patient are you, and how patient am I? Only when the final pieces were in place, the moving of Israel to Egypt, could he see. But his story didn't happen by accident. What about Job? When did his life story finally make sense to him? Well, for Job, the pieces didn't make sense until God answered out of the whirlwind. He had his three friends who came to comfort him. The best thing they ever did was the first week they spent with him. They didn't say a word. He referred to them as miserable comforters in Job 16 and verse 2 when they started yapping. Only Elihu, the young man who waited and waited and waited and finally spoke, to whom God offered no correction. It was like he gave a sermonette. You know, he was the warm-up act for God. His friends, the other friends, were more interested in preaching at him and then consoling with him. Here he sits on a pile of ashes with broken pottery scraping. In his mind, there was no doubt at all eventually that somehow God was just doing something he couldn't understand. As the book wears on, he defends himself as his friends are accusing him. Finally, Elihu says, you've all got it wrong. And then God speaks out of the whirlwind in verse 2 of chapter 38 when he says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? You know, in the great span of the cosmos, how much is even an entire human life, with all the tiny little lessons we can pick up on and the things we can learn, in the grand scheme of things, how much does that count for? Frame of reference. We want to keep learning as much as we can, but are we aware that there is so much more to the picture? The next four chapters are filled with pointed questions from God, reminding Job how little he really knew and how little room he had to hurl accusations against the God of the universe. Even then, it's not till Job's answer that the pieces finally come together, and we see it in the last chapter of Job, chapter 42. Job answered the Lord and said, verse 2, now I know that you can do everything, that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please let me speak. You said, I will question you and you will answer me. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear. I thought I knew who you were, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. Job finally had a perspective. It's interesting that as we look at the book of Job, it's clear that Satan didn't really get what God was doing. It seems that evil genius that he is, in one sense, a greater time perspective than any of us would have, of course, since he was created, but he didn't understand what God was doing. He saw it as some great contest with a chance for him to just pulverize one of God's great servants that God bragged on, in effect, to him. I put it that way. It's not bragging. We're just saying, have you noticed this man? But James wrote in James 5:11, he said, you have heard of the perseverance of Job, and he says, the end intended by the Lord. That the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. God had a purpose in mind, and Job couldn't see it for quite a while through this awful trial. God allowed what he allowed. He allowed Satan to torment Job, not because God had anything to prove to Satan. He used Satan's desire for destruction to help refine Job's character so he could come to the point where he said, now my eye sees you. Now I understand. The story wasn't by accident either. What about Esther? When did she know? Only after the plan by the wicked Haman became known. The desire to destroy all the Jews in Persia. It surfaces finally in chapter 3 and verse 13. Letters are sent out. Haman has convinced the king, Ahasuerus or Xerxes. All these letters are sent out on a certain day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, to plunder their possessions, to kill, destroy, annihilate young and old, little children, women in one day. And it was a law. The couriers went out, and apparently Esther was unaware of it. When Mordecai learned all about that in chapter 4, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went in the midst of the city and cried out with a loud and bitter cry. The symbols, the signs of extreme agony and grief in that culture. He went up to the front of the king's gate. No one could go there clothed with sackcloth. He stood outside and became known to Esther that her cousin is out there. What's going on? She sends out her messengers to find out what's happening. And so Esther calls Hathach, verse 5, one of the king's eunuchs whom he had appointed to attend to her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So he goes out to Mordecai, and Mordecai tells him what's happening. He told him all that had happened, the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He gave him a copy of the written decree, verse 8, for their destruction, which was given in Shushan or Susa, that he would show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication and plead for her people. So he returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai, and she spoke to him and she said, get back to Mordecai and tell him, look, here's what it is here. All the king's servants, verse 11, the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, there is but one law. They're put to death. Unless the king holds out the golden scepter to grant life. I myself have not been called for 30 days. Have I fallen out of favor? I don't know. It's been a month. I haven't seen him. Look at Mordecai's words. So Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think, verse 13, in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And then these words, yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. There it was. Why was she there? What was it all about? The book of Esther is somewhat unique and unusual in that the word God does not appear in the entire book. And yet it's obvious that his influence is throughout the whole thing. And Esther told Mordecai, gather the Jews in Susa and fast for me for 3 days. My maids and I will fast, and I will go to the king. It's against the law. But if I die, I die. We know the rest of the story. A very brave woman. And she finally understood why she was there. For such a time as this. Apparently it worked because when the Jews were given permission to defend themselves back at that time, kind of an interesting little quirky statement in the last verse of chapter 8, when these things all came about, it says in verse 17 of chapter 8, in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday, that's the feast of Purim. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Hey, I'm a Jew too! My first cousin, six times removed, back on my great-great-great-great-grandfather's side, must have been. I can speak Hebrew. Want to hear me? Quite a story. She finally knew. Esther's story didn't happen by accident either. What about the blind man? It took a miracle before his life made sense. He was blind in a culture where any misfortune of that kind was proof of sin. Who knows how many days he sat and begged for money, seeking to lessen the burden he must have been on his family's finances. Who knows how many times he heard the derision, the merciless reminders that he was born in sin, like I say, with people thinking because he couldn't see, he couldn't hear or understand either. Ignoring him is like just so much trash on the side of the road. That his condition was a just punishment, not a terrible tragedy. Who knows how often he struggled with those words and pondered them in the darkest corners of his own heart, saying, is it true? Is that all I am? A byproduct of sin? When the disciples saw him, what was their question? Lord, who sinned, this man or his parents? That was just their obvious, had to be. Jesus Christ's response must have silenced the crowd in John 9 and verse 3. It must have shocked them from that culture. He said, Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Then he goes on to talk about he's doing that work. He's doing that work. Boom. An entire cultural misconception shattered in a single moment. This man was born blind, not from sin, but for a purpose. For this moment. A lifetime of blindness culminating in one extraordinary miracle that would open the eyes not just of this man, but maybe many who stood watching. It was a healing that must have shaken a community to its core. When his parents were called before the Sanhedrin to explain what happened, They said, is this your son? Yes. Was he born blind? Yes. Can he see now? Apparently so. What happened? I don't know. He's a grown-up. Ask him. You know, everybody's passing the buck. So then they ask him. His parents had said these things, verse 22, because they feared the Jews, for the Jews already had agreed that if anyone confessed that Jesus was the Christ, that person who said that was true would be put out of the synagogue. That was the core of Jewish life in the first century in the area. To be banished from the synagogue was to be anathema in respected society. So they said, well, ask him. And they called him and they said, give God the glory. We know this man is a sinner. And his answer was, I don't know whether he's a sinner or not. I only know one thing. I was blind. And now I can see. What part of this don't you understand? I was blind, and now I see. Blind? See. It's not hard. Not rocket science. I don't think he said it's not rocket science. They said, well, what did he do to you? Describe the process. I don't know what the process was. I was blind. Now I can see. How did he open your eyes? He said, I already told you. Do you want to become his disciples? That probably wasn't a very popular answer. Then they reviled him and said, "You're his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know Moses spoke, or God spoke through Moses. We don't know where this fellow's from." And the man answered and said, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you don't know where he's from, and yet he's opened my eyes. We know God doesn't hear sinners, and if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he will hear him. And since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who is blind. If he were not from God, he could do nothing." That's pretty bold. And they said, "You were completely born in sins." There they go, back to the old premise. "And are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. Quite a story. How long did it take before he understood? Till he was called before the council. After a lifetime of blindness. It was a healing that shook the community. Jesus didn't just restore his vision. He's never had it. He created it. He created vision for him. Since the world began, it's been unheard of. His physical vision, lack of it, led him then, when he had it, to a spiritual conclusion that he was willing to accept, even when it meant being banished from the synagogue, the core of Jewish life in the first century. When Jesus revealed himself to this man as the Son of God, do you think he held any bitterness? I doubt it. I think he fell to the ground to worship his Creator. It was clear now that every single one of those years had been spent leading up to this one spectacular moment. Seeing and believing who this man was. The blind man's story didn't happen by accident either. Guess who we're going to look at next? What's your story? What kind of trials are you going through? Do all the pieces make sense immediately? One thing we have to believe, brethren, they will. Sometime they will. For some, it's been poor health. For others, challenging job situations. For others, devastated relationships. When do all the pieces of our lives make sense? I can't answer that for each individual. But I know someone who can. And I know he has a much broader frame of reference than we do. We have a few years, I learn a few lessons in a huge span of the existence of the human race, which is only a very tiny amount, a fraction of the existence of the universe, which we're told is constantly expanding, and that makes sense. And we're supposed to be a part of it all as children of God in his family forever. We'll have a little different frame of reference about 1,075,000 years from now. A little different. There is always a reason. Sometimes it doesn't make sense till the end of the story. We've seen God had his reasons in the lives of Joseph and Job and Esther and the blind man. He has his reasons in our lives too. Today, we look back on the lives of these four people in the Bible and we say, "I get it. I see it. There it is. Of course, I see it now because God explains it in his word. I see what he was doing in their lives." They didn't see it at first. Not one of them. One day, we'll look back at the difficult places and parts in our lives like that and we'll say, "I see it. I get it. I understand." Maybe we can't just yet. That's okay, because God can. We just don't have the right focus yet. We don't have the right frame of reference. It's just too limited. We see an earth that's standing still. God sees an earth that's flying around the sun at 66,000 miles per hour, which is hurtling around a galaxy that is rushing through an ever-expanding universe. How do you grasp that? God knows where he wants to take you and me. And he knows why. Do we trust him? The analogy of the potter and the clay comes to mind from Romans 9. The clay doesn't ask the potter, "What in the world do you think you're doing?" It's humbling sometimes, isn't it? Maybe sometimes we're not always sure what kind of vessel he's making us into. We'd like to be the really fancy vase. What if that's not quite what he has in mind, but it's something he wants and needs? We're not really in a position to criticize God's handiwork. How can we cast doubt on what he's planning or allowing in our lives? From where we are right now, we sometimes can't see any more clearly than Joseph or Job or Esther or the blind man. But they did. They came to see, and so can we. Turn to James chapter 1, and let's wrap this up. Here's the assurance. James 1, verse 2, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." That doesn't mean you're giddy and insanely happy, shrieking with joy. That doesn't mean that. It means we know it fits somehow, somewhere. Assuming we didn't cause the problem ourselves, which is also, quite possible. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, the margin says, mature and complete, lacking nothing. That's the assurance. There is a reason, even if we can't see it clearly from where we're standing in our lives right now. God has a reason for the things he allows. And again, we have to evaluate, did I just do something that had consequences, or is this something truly that's been allowed? The path to second in command of all of Egypt to work out God's plan to have Israel there to be sprung free from slavery began in a pit. The path to a deeper relationship with God began on a heap of ashes with a piece of broken pottery scraping your boils. The path to being a queen who rescued a people so that some of the descendants of that time and that culture would still be in the area and would be a society into which the Savior himself would be born. The path to the revelation of God's incredible power and perfect will began with a blind man who sat on the side of the road begging. When these stories began, the end was clear to nobody but God. When they ended, the value of every moment along the way became obvious. We may not understand our path completely until it's over. And that's okay. We don't have to. Not right now, not right this minute. God does. And in the meantime, there's one thing we can all rest assured of, a simple truth. Our stories are not happening by accident.